Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly with Alex Kratosky. In this week's show, we get to look at the internet through someone else's eyes, and we get a very different view of the web.
My whole house was raided. I was put on a four-seater private jet with all of my computers, CDs, etc., flown to London, Charing Cross holding cells, and on Monday morning, after 4 days in the holding cells, I was released from Westminster Magistrates Court. I believe you were outside.
Yeah, I was in the court, actually.
I remember you.
I tweeted saying, yeah, it looks like a young Keith Moon.
This week's show is dedicated to an interview with former LulzSec member and hacktivist Jake Davis, now released from serving time in a youth offenders facility and looking back on a dramatic turn in a young man's life. This is a special edition of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm joined by Charles Arthur, The Guardian's technology editor. And Charles, you met Jake Davis after following his story quite closely over the previous few years. Tell us who Jake Davis is.
So Jake Davis is better known to many people who might have followed the whole hacking story as Topiary. That was the name that he sort of gave himself, and he'll explain how he did that later. When he was in Anonymous, the Hacking Collective Anonymous chat rooms, and it then became his name when he was in the LulzSec hacking group, which about 3 years ago, so that's about March 2011, was just beginning to get off the ground after the whole sort of WikiLeaks, Anonymous, PayPal, Visa sort of attacks and hacks. LulzSec was a sort of splinter group from Anonymous, and he was sort of its voice in a way. He sort of drove its Twitter account. He came up with some of the sort of images and things that they used. So in that sense, he gave LulzSec its sort of public face. But as a hacking group, he wasn't, I don't think, so much involved in the hacking itself. But he helped to sort of give it the reputation, I guess, and the visibility with people once it had sort of done these various acts.
You followed LulzSec for quite some time, basically since its inception and since its sort of early seeds planted in Anonymous. Tell me, why did you get interested in this group in the first place? What intrigued you about them?
Well, I was sort of pointed to them. I'd been writing about the whole WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, Anonymous sort of axis, and the fact that Anonymous was very supportive of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks towards the sort of end of December, sort of the end of 2010 or so. The Guardian wrote a book about it. I contributed a chapter about Julian Assange and about all the hacking attacks that went on around that period. And in sort of February, March of 2011 or so, one of my contacts on Twitter said, all this stuff you've been writing, you should look at this group, LulzSec, and what they're doing. And so I started following what was going on there. And, there was a sort of it started with small things. They hacked into a news site and said that a famous rapper was actually who had been killed was actually alive in New Zealand. And then it sort of got bigger and bigger until they were doing things like hacking into the serious organized crime agency, bringing the website down, US Congress as well. And sort of they were active through from about March through to sort of end of summer of 2011. And then all sorts of things unraveled. There were all sorts of arrests. Then there were court hearings, very long bail periods. Then there was trial and sentencing. And that already sort of happened through 2012, 2013. So that brings us to the modern day. And pretty much any person who was in LulzSec who's not done some sort of prison time or been sentenced is a guy called Sabu, who is Hector Monsegur, who lives in New York and is a state's witness. Basically, he's a witness for the U.S. Government. And he was basically the person inside LulzSec who was actually telling the FBI what was going on, because they had got him very early on in the crew's sort of career. Basically, he was feeding the FBI all the information that it needed.
Well, let's dive into this interview, Charles, because it is fascinating. And I recommend sitting down with a cup of tea or maybe even going for a walk and having a good long listen to what Jake Davis has to say about his time as an underground hacker.
Jake, welcome.
Hi.
Tell us a little bit about how it all got started. How did you, I mean, you lived in Shetland. So to a lot of people, they'd think, how on earth would you get on the internet if you're in Shetland? I mean, just give us a picture of, you know, growing up in that distant part of the UK.
I guess the answer to your first question, how you get on the internet, is very, very slowly in the Shetlands. So I grew up just as we were switching in the Shetlands from dial-up to slow, the first sort of slow broadband. Early 2000s. And I found with my surroundings, of course, very remote. The Shetlands has a population of about 23,000. My island had a population of 900. So my local school had approximately 100 students. So everyone knew everyone before and after their sort of school. So you couldn't do one thing without it being distributed around the island. And I found sort of solace in my computer at home. When I was sort of tired of the local gossip and island happenings, I would just log on to either a chat room or Skype or a community, an online game perhaps, and speak with people that were far, far outside of that sort of landscape. On the Shetlands, you have the world is described as the mainland of the Shetland Islands, and anything further south than that is just a big kind of mysterious, it might as well be a different galaxy. And I was always interested in what was outside of that. So I found through the computer screen, there it was in a different way, in a much more vague way. But I sat and spent most of my childhood just online learning and consuming other cultures and people.
What sort of cultures did you find were the interesting ones? What were the things that you found there that you weren't able to find where you were living?
I had a fantastic friend. I'm still friends with him. A friend from New Delhi. He his kind of way of living so completely different, even on a day to day basis. Even to hear another accent through the screen that wasn't a Shetland accent was quite fascinating to me. So I set up a small sort of internet chat room where I brought together people from about, I don't know, six different countries together, and we just chatted online without specifically telling each other anything about ourselves. But I sort of assumed that we were all in the same position where the dots we were in around the world, we didn't particularly like that pocket and wanted to escape that without making it clear. So we're all having this sort of not really sharing that fact, but knowing that it exists, kind of innocent space online that we all went to. And that was sort of my childhood sort of haunt, sort of just a hideout. It's quite a sad one, a sort of chat room, but it was there. It's not like most kids have, I guess, a treehouse or a club or something.
Is it sad? I mean, if you're able to talk to people who are from a different culture, different experiences, is that a bad thing necessarily?
Sad in the mainstream, but no, I looking back, and it's a fantastic thing, and that sort of space still exists, though, of course, people have moved on, and obviously, but it was something I don't regret setting up.
You were using the internet in that way at a time before Facebook, really, and things like Instagram, the whole picture sharing, identity sharing sort of existence that a lot of, you know, younger people use today. Do you think that had an effect on how you viewed the internet and its usefulness?
Yeah, so my entrance point into the internet was that immediately when signing on, there was no real pressure to put in your home address or where you grew up or what school you went to. And of course, now you sign up. I tested by signing up to Facebook now, and that is a default question that comes up every time I log in. Where did you go to school? I ignore every time. But when I was growing up, that didn't exist anywhere. So I just had it in my kind of young mind, as did kind of most then, that the internet wasn't a place that you needed to socialize as a real person. It was a place you didn't need to be a real person because it was there. It was completely separate. So that's just how I naturally viewed it, and that's how it stuck as that view. So,
I mean, someone's once said that Facebook is a bit like the border guard of the internet. You know, it wants to know everything about you, and the difference between that there, you know, that experience now and the experience that you had then seems like quite a profound one in terms of sharing identity, sort of leaving breadcrumbs of who you are behind.
Yeah. So I guess the perception young people have of the internet now is that it's sort of Facebook is the net, like you say, and everything else is sort of the outside of it, disparate sort of portions. And I guess one of those was an ingress point into the net, and I never bothered going into the sort of centralized Facebook, Twitter sort of thing. That was just building up then. Twitter was just coming into play.
And then you sort of got involved with Anonymous, the as we tend to call it, our shorthand is the sort of loose hacking collective. And from then into Lulzsec, which, as I understand it, was a sort of spin out from Anonymous.
Right. So I was in a lot of chat rooms, of course, internet relay chat networks, which are completely the most anonymous you can possibly hope for, lowercase. A friend invited me to an anonymous, uppercase anonymous chat room. And I decided I was fascinated in the psychology behind it, psychology of hundreds of people, if not thousands of people in this chat room, which I'd never seen a sort of chat room on that level before, how they were coordinating, how they were talking. And I'm always interested in that sort of singularity and that sort of form everybody takes when they're all anonymous in a chat room in order to have their voice heard or to be like everyone else. They're trying to adopt this certain personality, and that's really fascinating with a few dozen people. With a few hundred, I thought that would be amazing. So I went in and I just made jokes at them, basically. There was no sort of political intent or anything like that. I was fascinated by the whole WikiLeaks case that was happening at the time. This was December 2010 during Cablegate, of course. And I ended up just staying in there, seeing the kind of numbers swell and the kind of psychology back and forth. And it got to the point where I was going from cracking jokes on the side to chatting with some of the people that were actually, you know, orchestrating things, to, you know, getting involved in that way, in writing and things like that. And the alias Topiary was just a bit of an accident. My chat client just happened to have that alias at the time, and it just automatically signed back in under that alias and identified itself. So it just stuck for another 7 or 8 months.
What sort of age were you at this time?
I was just turned 18 at the time when I first joined that first, I think it was Operation Payback chat room, and just kind of observing from the side.
That was the one which was about bombarding PayPal, I think, and
yeah, so that was ongoing, and I was sort of sitting there just in this chat room with like 7,000, something like that, people, just sort of observing this sort of mini culture breakout, and then the mainstream kind of picking up on it, and then just a flood of what Anonymous describes ordinary people joining and trying to interact and trying to understand. And it was just really, really fascinating on that level. Ended up becoming too fascinating in the coming months.
But what sort of psychology, I mean, what sort of personality does that chat room have when it's got thousands of people in there? Because you say that there are people trying to make themselves heard in it. What sort of personality comes through and is heard in that sort of situation?
So it's almost the most hate-filled, lack of empathy sort of persona you can adopt is the one that gets heard the most.
Why is that?
I guess it's born from image boards where you post content. You don't have an alias. You don't have a personality that you need to build up, like forums. So if you see a forum user with 1,000 posts, that guy can really say what he likes. It's going to be heard because of his past reputation. On these image boards, it's a constant cycle where you don't have that for any more than 3 seconds at a time. So it's whoever posts the best content fleeting at the time that wins. In a sense. So then it becomes whoever posts the most obscene content or the most shocking content that stays for the longest. So it's almost like a constant battle. Everyone's trying to kind of reach this kind of hate-filled singularity in order to get heard. And that then got projected onto Twitter. And so Twitter users weren't used to that. So we've got all these... journalist Quinn Norton makes this great point that people don't understand uppercase anonymous users on Twitter because they're kind of spouting hate toward each other, but that's completely normal. They're coming from a space where they have to do that. You don't have to do that on Twitter, obviously, so that's that kind of subculture broke into the mainstream social media as well after the Payback.
And then you sort of found yourself, is that the wrong phrase, in Lulzsec?
Yeah, found myself is quite right. I decided to quit the whole sort of scene after I realized it got too far with my appearance on a radio show where a few people hacked into the kind of racist Westboro Baptist Church, and that went more viral than I thought it would. It was a bit personally identifying, so I thought at that point this kind of curiosity has gone too far. I need to shut the laptop lid and maybe get a life, in simple terms. And that sort of lasted for 2 or 3 weeks before I realized I was not getting a life as well as I thought, and just got back into it because it was easy to get back into it. It was sort of right there on the screen, and I didn't have anything else going on. And so myself and other sort of personalities that had built up during that time decided to sort of form a rather ridiculous splinter group of the Anonymous movement.
Did it have a purpose? Did Lulzsec sort of have a... Did it have a sort of overarching aim? Was there, you know, what they call in the movies, the high concept?
Of course. So with so many different people in it, I guess I can't speak for others. It was just so many different. Some were more politically focused. Some just wanted to cause carnage. I was trying to, in a very naive way, sort of adopt that satire of corporate and sort of media online, where you can set up a, you set up like businesses set up a Twitter account and they use these ridiculous hashtag campaigns set up by kind of clueless marketing teams, and to promote content that, because this was just starting, and sort of this group would do this is malicious, crazy criminal activity that we all regret now, in a sort of style that was not unlike that any business would attempt to sell a brand. So hashtags for hacking operations and sort of the same sort of rhetoric, and it works in roughly the same way. And that was sort of something that was completely blanketed over, because no one wants to report on that sort of pretentious stuff. They just want to say CIA website down. So that was a sort of beginning, and then of course who knows where it went, because everybody got. I think the people involved were young. I was 18, another boy was 16 at the time. Things just started getting way out of hand, and then of course there was a FBI informant within the group, and there were various other dramas that came on board. So,
I mean,
it spiraled
bit,
out of control.
It sounds a bit like you sort of wanted it to be a bit like the Yes Man, which is a sort of group that often, you know, they fake BP accounts and things like that, and you know they ran a fake BP Twitter account during the oil spill in Texas, I think, and you know, lots of people would believe it. And it sounds as though you wanted to make sort of hacking as theatre, but as a comment on sort of things that were going on.
Well, kind of situation as it stands with kind of wider internet. Yeah, I guess what I wanted to do from the Shetlands was sort of look at how the internet was changing from going back to when I was growing up on it and having not put any personal information into it, seeing people my own age now. If you didn't do that, that was considered weird. You were supposed to sort of tell the internet who you are, where you are all the time, and that's normal. You're supposed to connect in that way and share your thoughts and pictures or whatever else. So I wanted to find a way to sort of mock that and not kind of sit on the side and write sort of letters about it, but sort of really show it for what it is. And if I had another way to do that, I probably would, but this was sort of the easiest, and people around me were doing sort of massive thing. It was getting all this attention, and it was you know, at times it was companionship with the other people around me as well. My kind of real life friend base was incredibly low at that point, counting them on one hand. It was just everything was just. I knew it was sort of not a wise decision to sit there, sort of sitting indoors doing this sort of thing. But it was all I had at the time.
I mean, and then there were various arrests made with Lulzsec, there's trial, sentencing, and so on. I just want to focus on one particular period in there, which is you were bailed after your arrest. You're in London court. One of the bail conditions was you weren't allowed to connect to the internet. You couldn't use an internet, couldn't use a PC that would connect to the internet, couldn't use a phone that would connect to the internet. And I'm very interested by what the experience was like for you, having gone from this childhood spent on the internet and all this time all spent on the internet to a completely no internet at all experience. Because I think most people would be interested and know what it's like, but most people go, I'm not getting off the internet, you know, or they say they will, but they don't.
Right.
But to have it caught in force, that's pretty serious. Mm. So what was that like?
Well, firstly, they should get off the internet for a bit. Just briefly on how that transition happened from Shetland to London, very quick. So I was arrested 27th of July. My whole house was raided. I was put on a four-seater private jet with all of my computers, CDs, etc., flown to London, Charing Cross holding cells. And on Monday morning, after 4 days in the holding cells, I was released from Westminster Magistrates Court. I believe you were outside.
Yeah, I was in the court, actually.
I remember you.
I think you tweeted saying, it looks like a young Keith Moon.
I couldn't see that tweet, obviously, from being banned from the internet, which is a good segue into now being banned from the internet. So yeah, I was released from Westminster Magistrates Court and went to live with my mother again on an electronic tag. So on combination with that internet ban, I was... I had this large G4S, who now don't do tagging contracts, around my ankle. This huge tag, and I had to be in my house every night by 10 p.m. Mm-hmm. So that was my August 1st, 2011, was my first day without the internet. And that lasted for another 2 years. So, yeah, this two-year period. For the first week, it was just nice not to be in a police holding cell. And without the sort of massive attention going on. So my mind was focused on what just happened in the last 4 days and how I'm going to cope with that and quantify it. And, you know, there was, of course, initial evidence from the case coming in bundles of paper, because the first issue without using the internet was I was banned from a computer that could use the internet, and I had no money at the time, so I couldn't afford to buy a computer and modify it so it couldn't go offline. And we as defendants in the case weren't allowed our evidence in electronic form. So a hacking trial obviously has a lot of evidence in computer form, hundreds of thousands of pages. So instead of receiving that on a disk, I got it in large bundles of paper, which ended up taking up probably less space.
Wow.
The size of this studio in the end. So that was the first real issue. More reading was done in terms of that. And for the few months after that, I was quite enjoying it. I suppose being stripped from the internet wouldn't be like another one of my schoolmates in Shetland or something being stripped from the internet, because I didn't have a identity there. So it felt like there were no Facebook or Twitter feeds or anything like that under my real name that were left inactive. So it wasn't like I was removing myself from it. I was removing this sort of alias I'd built up from it, which was quite a lovely feeling for a while, knowing I could just leave this sort of dark thing behind that had built up, and it was really starting to kind of corrupt me. So it felt like I was sort of pushing that aside. And that went on for another year. I was just feeling like I don't really need the internet. And then I tried to apply to colleges, and they were really suspicious about the whole thing, and I ended up not being able to get in. And then finding jobs was, of course, incredibly difficult, because they expect you to at least have an email address, and the courts wouldn't let me have an email address. Or if I were to work from an office, they wanted a team of police officers, detectives, to go to that office and sort of inspect all the computers, and that obviously put off employers as well. And the real issue started when I moved to London in January last year. So I had this curfew.
It's January 2013 then.
January 2013, apologies. And I had a different company, Soko, who are also banned from tagging now. Soko tag around my ankle. My curfew had been moved to midnight due to work.
What sort of work were you doing?
So this was kind of my first job when banned from the internet, which was an interesting one. So I worked as a freelance front of house at Somerset House on this theatre production called In the Beginning Was the End by a company called Dream Think Speak, which is a sort of immersive piece where the audience goes through the tunnels underneath and experiences things around them. So I worked as, I kind of just sat in a suit with a little radio, sort of making sure I knew where all the audience were and guiding them in the right directions. So I sat outside in this red blinking corridor where this mad scientist was making electricity with lemons in his pajamas at the back. With this huge like electronic tagging device around my ankle, with a phone with no Wi-Fi antenna in it, and my job ended at about 11:15 every night, so I had to leave the show, which was difficult because you can't just walk out; you have to go through all these back passages so the audience doesn't know you're part of the show. But about 11:15 every night, just because I wanted that extra hour, because I had no money at the time, so I had to work. It was by the hour, so otherwise I'd work till 2-3 in the morning, running home to get there, which I got in about 20 to midnight every night. So my whole sort of schedule was built around this curfew, and the lack of internet made it difficult, obviously, in London, because I'm from the Shetland, I don't know public transport, cities, anything like that, so I couldn't access GPS. So I was running between the maps, the physical map systems around London, for about 6 months trying to find my way home.
Couldn't you have bought an A to Z?
I had a little A to Z, which with bookmarks and and all kinds of markings that I flipped around. I looked ridiculous kind of flipping it around, and I just at that point learned the concept of an Oyster card and, you know, the bus system, the tube system. So it was a scary thing. That was the main issue, no GPS, which might not sound like that. I guess most people would say I miss Facebook or Twitter or something, but those things didn't exist. So it was mainly just the accessibility of how it was hindering my ability to get work and actually just find my way around in the world, which, of course, I never used it before. I never appreciated it as that. Having that function.
So it sounds as though the real issue was, I mean, as you say, is the GPS, the being able to get directions and stuff, and also that it's become embedded into job applications, I suppose, benefit applications, all those sorts of things. The things that many people think of as just day-to-day, actually now, if you're completely blocked off from them, then life becomes a great deal harder.
Yeah, it's so. I guess the net's become so mainstream now. It's just taken as a granted for everything, and I would can't fathom going into a job interview or any kind of meeting and for someone to say, okay, I'll email you, and then you have to go, actually, you can't email me, and then having to sort of slowly, to some people, you don't want to sort of say I'm banned from the internet, because that opens a whole new can of worms, but even signing up to a non-internet plan on my phone was difficult, so I had to call them and say, call my phone provider and say, I can't have legally have internet. Now, first I started with, I can't have internet on my phone, I don't want it. And they said, it's actually cheaper if I have internet. I said, no, I really can't have internet. And then I had to move into, I can't legally have internet. And they sort of were skeptical, but said, okay. So they needed to set up an email address on my behalf for my account. And I said, because another condition was I couldn't access the internet, but I couldn't ask anyone to use the internet for any reason on my behalf. So I couldn't ask them to set up an email address. So I said, please set up an email address, but don't tell me what it is and don't tell me what the password is unless I call you with this, like, another security question and want to know it. But at this moment, I can't know what my own email address is. I just can't have the internet. So it took me about a week to set up a sort of text-only phone plan. If anyone is up for an experiment, just try to go about anything for a week without in any way accessing the net and trying to explain to other people you can't use the internet. Quite comedic for a while, if it weren't for frustrating.
It sounds like something out of Kafka, you know. It'd be sort of, you know, Kafka did the trial and now you do the bail.
Exactly.
But that eventually did end. You were sentenced. You went to a young offenders institution. And you have quite strong opinions about the treatment that you received, that you saw others receive there. What? Tell us about that.
I was put in Feltham Young Offenders, which is, for people that don't know, basically the most notorious young offenders in the country, where they have to segregate wings by different gangs because of fights. And the reason I was sent there is because it's the closest prison to the court I was tried at, so that the van drivers don't have to drive as far. So these van drivers get paid £1,000 per trip, Soko vans, and you're sent to the prison that you're closest to.
So it's nothing to do with convenience, to do with parental visits?
No. My mother lived in Spalding, which is in the Midlands, so she complete distance. So Feltham's sort of a segue prison where you're sort of assessed and then you move on to somewhere else. So it's a sort of remand institute. But I was sentenced to 2 years, and because of the time I spent on the tag and good behavior in prison, etc., it was knocked down to, I think, 37 days, then 36 days, because I was scheduled to be released on a Saturday, and they don't want to release prisoners on a weekend. So they can either release you on the Friday afternoon or Monday. If they release you the following Monday, they've kept you 2 days illegally, so they owe you £180, £90 per day. So they just go ahead and release people a day early so they don't have to pay them. So I ended up being knocked down to 36. And, well, my first impression was maybe skewed compared to other offenders. So I was put in this sort of reception area with this tray of food, like a sort of school cafeteria. BBC News was playing constantly on this sort of very protected, glassed-off screen. Of course, my face was on it. And so I was kind of looking around at these typical prison inmates, if you can imagine, kind of tough-looking people, just thinking, this isn't going to go well. And they completely sort of loved the whole challenges to the government, challenges to the form. And of course, that wasn't particularly my intention, but when you're in a room with the types of people that have, like, tattoos all over them, and they're quite threatening, I played into it. And it ended up, I got a strange level of respect from a culture I didn't understand. And I realized in there that one of my cellmates, I believe he was sentenced for smashing a car with a pickaxe and then stealing something along the way. And he breached his parole about 12 times. And this was just a kid. So I helped him.
Sorry, what sort of age was he?
He was, so everyone was 18 to 21, and I think he was 19. So actually younger than me when I went in. So I would have been 20 when I went in. And I realized that all of these people, you know, there were some high-profile drugs kind of barons in there. There's some manslaughter, all sharing the same space. And I had three different cellmates, each in for quite serious crimes. And I realized everyone is roughly the same as long as they can relax, sort of have their television on most of the time, have a cup of tea, and I sort of helped inmates write letters to their family and sort of spell words, things like that, which I thought would be nice. I just think that the guards in there were sort of adopting this sarcastic persona because they realized sort of aggression won't work on these young people, so they adopt, we don't really care about your feelings sort of thing, which works very well psychologically.
In what way? To reinforce them as guards or to calm people down?
I say works well, I think it's quite disgraceful, but it works well in the fact that they're sort of diffusing a situation and not. I guess it's a very trained sort of thing, and so in terms of a daily regime, I guess would be interesting. You wake up at eight, The guards don't wake you up, but breakfast is known to be at 8:30, and you sort of go out and collect your little packs of cereal and sugar sachets and tea bags from a little bag on a pool table in the wing. And if you're not up, you don't get any. And between 8:30 and 8:30, you ask for a small orange plastic razor with one blade. And if you don't ask for a razor at that point, you can't shave for the rest of the day. And you have 15 minutes to shave, or you have to give it back. And if you're half shaven, you don't get to shave to the next day. After that, you're put back in your cell. So it's 23 hours a day in total in the cell. You're put back in your cell. Lunch, a door opens, and you sort of just get thrown a baguette and tossed a piece of fruit based on your selection. Dinner is at 4:30, and that's about 2 minutes out of the cell while you sort of go along with your tray and get things put onto your plate like you would at school. And you're put back in. That's it. That's your out time for the day. If you're lucky, you get an hour or so association where you all, well, basically association is where you all congregate in the wing and just fight for the pool table or play cards. I sat and played cards with a bunch of people, my kind of thing. And of course there's a sort of betting system for food that goes on, but you're not allowed to bet, but it's not really something you're not allowed to. The guards just don't like it because they don't like someone hypothetically getting into debt with packs of noodles and then someone getting beaten up because of it. So there's sort of a mental thing going on for food betting. And you're in your cell for the rest of the night, hungry from about 4:30 till 8:00 the next morning. So I'm trying to campaign in any way just to have that fixed. I think serving food at those hours and sort of deliberately not letting prisoners out for more enrages them in the evening. And if you're a young person and you've just been sent to prison, and in the most case, waiting to be sentenced, not like for me, it was easy to cope with mentally because I knew how long I was going to do. These people are in there not knowing whether they get 2 years, 6 years, 10 years. And you're on edge at that point. So when you're left all evening to stew on edge, especially if your television power gets cut off when you want to watch your favorite episode of EastEnders, which I've learned the plot from because of prison, you're angry by the next morning. So you come out for this 8:00 breakfast with all this pent up rage. Fights get started because that goes on record as fights were started at breakfast. Breakfast gets shut down to a stricter regime. And so I've just realized, having shared a cell with someone that was in for manslaughter, who is perfectly docile as long as he has this cup of tea in his episode of EastEnders, and knowing I saw about 4 fights and they were all the fault of sarcastic guards. And I saw one boy try to hang himself, and I didn't see. We heard he didn't. He just wanted to be let out of his cell to help clean. At that point, I had a cleaning job because the guards wanted me out of my cell because they like asking me ridiculous questions like, "Do aliens exist? Is Area 51 real?" All of this stuff, and
they thought you'd know this because you've been on the internet.
I guess they thought I'd know this sort of. So I kind of doled it out, realizing how long I've been in there, and ridiculous questions. But I guess from a guard's perspective, they just liked conversation. They were bored. Their life was in prison as well. They spent most of their days there sitting doing paperwork.
How would you contrast? I mean, you described earlier the internet chat rooms with thousands of people and the sort of the hate singularity, that sort of hateful persona was the one that would survive. How would you contrast to the sort of persona that survives in a youth offenders institution?
Well, I had this...
Where you're actually seeing each other.
Yeah. I had this bizarre overlap between the two when you're in your cell, either on your own or with your cellmate, and the only way you can communicate with everyone else in the wing is by shouting through the windows, through the air vents on the windows that occupy the entire sort of space. Shouting things to, like, if you're in cell 13, cell 6 owes you some noodles, cell 6 owes you some cigarettes. You shout to cell 10 to shout to cell 6. So you're this sort of disparate sort of echoing voices shouting back and forth everywhere. They are literally at some points voices in your head. So you have about 9 cells going back and forth, repeating to each other all these ridiculous things, having to be as sort of rude as possible or neutral as possible in terms of feelings so that so you don't just get everybody in cell banging on your door for saying something slightly wrong, which is sort of it's maybe too much of a leap, which is sort of what I was feeling online. So that's something I wrote about quite a lot, and I guess everyone is scared in their cell, no matter who they are. Everyone is they're all sort of 18 to 21 year old boys, not knowing what's going to happen with their life. So this 1 hour you're allowed out for association, suddenly everyone sort of gets up off their bed, puts on their sort of prison tracksuit, and just rolls out of the door, all with the same sort of swagger that I found myself doing a little bit, just to keep up appearances. So I realized my cellmate was a timid kind of guy. He was constantly talking about his girlfriend who he missed, his mother who he wanted to write to, who I was helping him, what he wanted to do. And the second he came out of this cell, just like everybody else, they were adopting that sort of slang, sort of, yo, blood, how's it going, sort of persona, which is just really fascinating.
And having been released, what are you doing now? And what's your view of the internet and the web now? You know, now that it's now that you can have as much of it as you want or as little of as you want, how do you integrate it into your life? And what sort of lessons do you think there are that other people could learn from?
Oh, big questions. I found, having been back on the internet, the first thing I did was sort of piece together the phone that the guards broke apart and found my way home via GPS. That was the first thing I did. And then Google came into play. And from being back online, I kind of had this fresh outlook of it. I wanted to know what parts of the internet I actually need. So I didn't sign up to Facebook. I have no sort of... My social media presence is singularly based on Twitter, which is just something very vague and easy for me to do. And so my only activity on the internet now is, to this day, which is, so I was released from prison 9 months ago. I have several email accounts, a Twitter feed, and a Skype account. And that's pretty much my computer use.
Ask FM as well? You've been on that?
Ask
me anything.
Sorry. Yeah, I wanted a way for, because right now I'm banned from speaking to anyone anonymous, uppercase anonymous. So I wanted this sort of space where I could be, because everyone had questions about this sort of thing, I get a lot of emails from young people who are in the place that I was several years ago, asking. I keep their identities and kind of points private, mostly asking, you know, what they can do, and a lot of people saying, oh, you're a hero, I want to do this kind of stuff, and me going, no, don't get involved in the web at a deeper level, you'll end up sort of getting involved in circles you don't want to. And sort of just advising them on a psychological level what it kind of feels like in dealing with people that have sort of agoraphobia, and something I went through quite an extreme level. That was the first shock of me coming back online. I set up this public email. I got just this flood of individuals wanting to remain as anonymous as possible, just kind of opening up about that kind of stuff, thinking I'd understand. So I wanted to set up this space where anyone could ask me a question and I could answer it. And most of them are just silly, because I don't want to use that sort of space to be taken too seriously, but there's a few points about the case in there that I just want to put in my own words, and it's just easy, you dump it out there without any identities coming into play, because I'm always skeptical online of, if I'm speaking to someone, say I find someone new online, I chat over email for a week, and then they suddenly say, I used to be in an anonymous chat room, and offhand, and then I have to say, look, I probably shouldn't be speaking to you. I don't know what else you do online. I don't know what you have open in other windows while you're emailing me. I can't really be involved in this. So it's sort of cutting off communications quite a bit.
Why is that anonymous capital A restriction in there, and how long does it last?
So that lasts until June, and it was enforced. So it's not enforced upon some of my other co-defendants who also went through the same process. It got enforced on me because, when I was in Feltham, one of my co-defendants, arrested for anonymous, Ryan Cleary, just sent me, who had been remanded in Feltham for breaching his bail and going back on the internet. He'd been in there for quite some time, and he'd been moved to another prison. He sent me a letter while in prison. At this point, I was allowed to speak to people because it was that sort of window where there were no post-prison rules enforced. So he sent me this letter, which I won't quote, because to respect his privacy, that just said he's really sorry for what he did. And how he came across online. He, of course, was one of the most aggressive, and he had, you know, and how he wanted to move on with his life, and how every time I came into court, he would come from prison. So he and I would come, everyone else would come from the outside world, and he was just really happy that everyone was trying to move on and kind of hold up that face. And he how he wanted to change his life and leave his house and get friends. And he wanted me to help him do that. Because he'd seen sort of the progress I was making. So I sent him a brief letter back going, thanks for the letter. Obviously, we can't really know each other too much afterwards because it's just so bizarre and strange, and this whole past thing needs to be left behind. But I said I'd introduce him to some friends, help him around, you know, try and get him some work or something. Just a very sort of, we all understand, we're hoping we're moving on sort of thing. And the police intercepted that letter, from what I know, read them, and then decided to tell my probation officer, before I'd met my probation officer the first time, that there had been communication between the hackers. Briefly just kept it at that, as if to say they were plotting something again. I'm not saying they were, but that was roughly what I know. And so this order was enforced. I believe the day I was released from prison that I couldn't associate with anyone associated with Anonymous or formerly associated with Anonymous or LulzSec or, and some names specifically. So that was enforced, and that expires in June, though I have no real desire to get back into those sort of hateful chat rooms. But it would be nice to have that pressure off, where if someone emails me and says the wrong thing, I can just go, look, it's fine, I don't want to be involved in that, but I can speak to you at least.
On the basis that no experience is wasted, is there anything you would do differently now? Yeah, if you could go back and live it again, you know, start off back in the Shetlands again.
At like 13, 14. How far do we want to go back?
Well, back to the point where you get on the internet. You know, would you have not done anything? Would you have just differently?
I'm really grateful that I've learned so many things differently from I guess what most young people. And so I dropped out of school when I went online about 13 or 14. I don't regret that. I think I lack certain skills because of that, and especially organizational skills. But I have this different kind of perspective because of it as well. And I don't regret that. I wish I'd found a more salubrious way to get across the whole sort of pretentious, look what the corporations are doing to the internet thing, without getting in so much trouble and it spiraling out of control into this sort of anti-police thing that I really didn't like. If that bit were calmer, and that was one thing I couldn't bear in court. Everything else, I try to take the best things from it and bring it to what I do now. So, which is trying to blend sort of art and technology in any way, and I'm trying to do more of the sort of immersive theatre stuff I was speaking about, my first kind of job when banned from the internet, and blending that in a sort of digital way. So I work with various people consulting on that, and trying to take the expertise from that and help writers and directors and things in putting it across in an accurate but sort of positive way that, you know, that I can take from that. Because I don't want to forget about it all, because that's sort of a unique skill set, but I don't want to use that and profit from it. So of anything I do, like at the Wired conference or any other talk, I just give to either an autistic charity or prison advice charity or something like that, just because I don't want to. Profiting from crime is a sort of a sketchy thing, and profiting from sort of something that's related to crime is all too much. So I think it's just nice to take the bad things from that and give it away. So it's just mentally, it's just nice to get it off my chest like that. So to answer the long-winded question, no, I don't regret it, but I try to do the bits I do regret. I try to take the nastiness from that in an abstract way, push it into something that's positive.
Jake Davis, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
A huge thanks to Jake Davis, and that's all we have for you this week. For all of Charles Arthur's writings, go to theguardian.com/technology. But for me, Alex Krotowski, and Tech Weekly producer Jason Phipps, thank you very much for listening. Bye-bye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.